Call the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee to order today, and today we have an informational meeting on property tax and lottery. So, why don't we get started?
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Dave Back, Legislative Revenue Office. We're going to take an overview of Oregon's property tax. We start with history and significance of property tax, and of course we talk about Measure 5 and Measure 50, and we're going to take a look at statistics and individual components trends. And we're going to end the discussion with property assessment and urban renewal. As you know already, Oregon's property tax system is one of the most important sources of revenue for the public sector in Oregon. This source is supposed to raise $4.47 billion for fiscal year 07-08. Only state personal income tax collections exceed property tax collections as a source of state and local revenue. A couple of useful definitions, real market value and assessed value. Real market value is the amount in cash which could be reasonably be expected from a voluntary exchange of property in an arm's length transaction, meaning no close family members, real close friends, just doing favor to each other. Assessed value for our purpose is value of property subject to taxation. Measure 5, the structure of the property tax changed very little until the 90s, when two statewide ballot measures dramatically changed the system. Measure 5 introduced property tax rate limits, was passed in 1990 and became effective year after for 91-92 tax year. When fully implemented in 95-96, Measure 5 cut property taxes an average of 51% from their 90-91 levels. Measure 50, passed in 1997, did several things. First, cut property taxes, introduced assessed value growth limits, and replaced most tax levies with so-called permanent tax rates. And permanent rate came about with the direction of Measure 50 using complicated formula. And it is understood as maximum rate that can be imposed without voter approval. This Measure 50 transformed the system from one primarily based on levies to the one primarily based on rates. Between Measure 5 and Measure 50, we had a little bit of a hybrid system. Before Measure 5, it was levy-based. When implemented in 1997-98, Measure 50 cut effective tax rates an average of 11% from 96-97 levels. A couple of quick cheat sheets on limits. First, Measure 5, called Measure 5 limits, or government tax limitations. That's $5 per $1,000 real market value for schools, $10 per $1,000 real market value for general government taxes. These limits only apply to operating taxes, not exempt bonds. These limits are calculated for each property. For each property, school taxes and general government taxes are compared to their limits respectively. It's not the combined limits, it's separate limits, 5 for schools, 10 for general government. Measure 50. According to Measure 50, assessed value for 1997-98 was set at 90% of 95-96 assessed value for each property. And the permanent rates were established for taxing districts. Annual growth for assessed value was limited to 3% for existing property. For new property, we have real market value times assessed value divided by real market value of similar property. And this is closely related to so-called changed property ratio. So the summary of Oregon property values and taxes imposed for 07 and 08 and growth over a year. Real market value for 07-08 was $501 billion. And total assessed value was $280 billion. And net assessed value was $271 billion. Out of that, all property taxes imposed was $4.47 billion. Included in it is urban renewal taxes of $191 million. Now, if you look at the growth of real market value, was over 15%. Total assessed value increased 5.7%, and net assessed value increased 5.4%. All property taxes increased by 9.6% between 06-07 and 07-08.
And Dave, that includes the local option votes that people have in various districts?
Yes, Madam Chair, yes. In bond taxes, a couple of bonds, one so-called gap bonds, its principals and interests are being paid for by operating taxes. And there's local option about $600 million in this figure. So local option is about $600 million. The rest is gap bonds.
Senator Morris.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The difference between total assessed value and net assessed value, what is the deduction or elimination there?
Madam Chair and Senator Morse, there are three items that distinguish between total assessed value and net assessed value. The bulk, over $9 billion, come from so-called urban renewal access value, which is the incremental value from the frozen base property values before the urban renewal plan started. So $9.3 billion, to be exact, is coming from so-called urban renewal access value. There are a couple of minor items under $100 million. Assessed value and taxes imposed. Total assessed value has been increasing substantially more than 3%. Our perception is, well, assessed value should not grow more than 3% a year. Well, that 3% growth limit applies to individual properties assessed value. But there will be new constructions and property improvements, and all this will add to assessed values. So if you look at previous slides, total net assessed value increased 5.4%. Of course, the real market value these days in many areas are declining. That introduces a little twist here. The operating taxes we discussed in the previous slide, it's the taxes from permanent rates and that fund general operating budgets. Measure 5 limits in terms of types of taxes, the type of taxes that are subject to limit are permanent rate, local option, gap bond, pension levy, and urban renewal plan taxes. And bond levies for capital construction are not subject to the limit. In terms of district, in our purpose, district is a local government entity that imposes property taxes. A district can include multiple taxing districts. For example, City of Salem would have parts of city located in Marion and Polk counties. The type of districts, we have K through 12, we call it school, education service district, city, county, community college, and special district. And special district will include service, port, fire, and park, library, transit, public utility, and many others. Property taxes by type of district. Out of total property taxes, the K through 12 and ESDs use 42%. And cities, 23%, counties, 19%, and special districts, 12%, and community college, 4%. Property taxes by type of tax.
Could you go back to that last slide for a sec? How does that square with the city and county compared to the K through 12 and ESDs? They're about the same on there. In fact, exactly the same. How do you square that with the $5 and $10 per thousand?
Okay, so this and this together are school limits. So K through 12, ESDs, and community college all together, mm-hmm. They're subject to a $5 limit.
Right, mm-hmm. That'd be 46%. And the cities and counties are very close to that, and they get $10. Well, so help me out here.
Madam Chair, I think one of the explanations is that the schools are a lot closer to their Measure 5 limit than are the sum of the local government units.
Okay, so this
so
is
you have counties that have, you know, wide variations in their permanent tax rates.
Okay.
You know, varying from 60 cents to $8, whereas most all of the K-12 and ESDs are right in the same level, although there is some variation there in permanent rates, but they're pretty close. So I think that would clearly be one of the explanations.
Yeah, that totally makes sense. Thanks. Go ahead.
Okay. Thank you. Again, back to property taxes by type of taxes, permanent rate and gap explain 77% of total property taxes imposed. Urban renewal, 4%. Bond is 13%. This just doesn't include gap. Local option, 8%. Now, these two previous slides combined, we have this chart. From 06-07 and 07 and 08, between two fiscal year, total district taxes increased 9.4%. Out of that, well, if you look at individual components, permanent rate and gap portion increased 6.6%, local option increased 34%, and then bond portion increased 17.5%. And urban renewal increased 16.1%. Altogether, the property tax increased 9.6%. Now it's reaching at $4.47 billion for fiscal year 07-08. This chart shows assessed value and real market value. And, of course, we have divergence starting from here. If you look closely at it, here we have property based on assessed value. We have gradual decline since 91-92 year to 95-96, and then a little pickup 1 year, and then a slight decline, and then gradual increase over here. So the occasions that mark the transitions or the shift of the curve or change in direction of the curve is Measure 5, and Measure 5 fully phased in 95-96, and then, of course, 97-98 fiscal year is the first year of Measure 15.
Senator Morris.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So it's possible that new construction is paying less property taxes than some of the older construction that's had that 3% cumulative over the years.
Madam Chair and Senator Telfer, if you go back how we calculate the assessed value for properties.
Right, and that's because of that. New construction could be paying less in property taxes than older construction.
Is it possible?
Yeah. Madam Chair, Senator Telfer, my name is John Phillips of the Oregon Department of Revenue. I'm here to help out a little bit, and I think I might be able to answer that in part. Many of you have heard, and Dave just mentioned the term changed property ratio, and that is the factor that's making the difference between, let's say, an existing home and a new construction. It's all over the board, though. Mm. Most of the stories we hear are that the changed property ratio is going down each year, and that's a function of market value increasing so much. And now we're in a time where that's changing, but whether it'll change and restore the changed property ratio back up to where it was, you know, we don't know.
Okay. Paul.
And I'll just add, Madam Chair, the hearing for our newer members, interim hearing that the Senate committee had in Tigert, that was really the focus of some of the variations we see in that ratio of assessed value to market value. Some of it has to do with when new property came on, it would come on at the average for that county. But if property doesn't change hands, that ratio can be a lot different of assessed value to market value depending on market trends. And the committee heard from a number of taxpayers who came in and said, well, you know, my property is taxed higher than my neighbor's even though the market value is the same. And that can very well happen under the system because it depends on market trends since those rates were established and since that ratio was established.
And also where you were in the cycle when the property last changed hands. And so you would indeed have cases where a new construction could have a lower tax burden than an existing structure in the same neighborhood, correct?
Yes, absolutely.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, or any, you know, that was those people that came in right across the street from each other paid, you know, a difference, and it wasn't small. It was $1,000
right.
Difference. And that was the argument for repealing Measure 50. I think Don McIntyre, in fact, proposed doing this. Repealing Measure 50 and then lowering the rate, which makes...
And returning to a market value basis is what...
Go back to their market value.
And it's worth noting in this context, and this also came up in our hearing in Tigard, that when Measure 50 passed, there's a constitutional provision guaranteeing equal treatment, equal tax treatment for similar situations. And Measure 50 specifically exempted itself from that requirement. So basically we have in our Constitution an exemption to the principle that similarly situated taxpayers should be treated the same. And so you have wild variations for the same house that's worth $500,000 in a different neighborhood. One could pay a fourth the tax the other pays because of that provision of Measure 50. Senator Morris.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If we could go back to slide 15. If you look at the trend line, and you did a regression analysis, pre-Measure 5 and then post-Measure 5, someone would look at this slide and say, well, we really don't have property tax limitations because the trend is steeper after Measure 5 than it is before. So it's a little bit misleading just to look at it on the basis because it includes new properties, growth, and it's on a gross collected basis rather than a real tax payer reflection. So I would just point that out that when someone looks at that.
Well, and another thing that's inherent in that trajectory is that one of the things Measure 5 did was it, because in the past business property had tended to be fully assessed and residential property was not, one of the provisions in Measure 5 required up-to-date market assessments. And so what you had there was a difference in the proportion of property tax paid by individual properties versus business properties. So it ended up being quite a substantial break for business properties. And I might add the business community overall opposed Measure 5, so they weren't, you know, supporting this, but it reduced their taxes and provided very little relief for individual properties, which led to the passage several years later of Measure 50, because they didn't get the property tax relief they were promised.
Madam Chair, this actually is the total aggregate. So a lot of new construction, new residents, and increase in assessed value account for this increase. But if you look at the next chart, average tax rate, roughly calculated by property tax divided by assessed value, remained very stable. That's about a little over $15 per $1,000 assessed value. So we can square that aggregate with average tax rate with individual property, yes. Property taxes as share of Oregon personal income was stable at about a little over 3%. And this is taken from our basic facts book for fiscal year 05-06. The property tax burden among the state is 30th, about in the middle, a little. The property tax per person was about 1,000. The latest figure is about 1,150. Per person. As a lead into administrative side discussion, appraisal is the process of identifying and assigning a value to a property, and county assessors do most property assess appraisal in Oregon. And Oregon Department of Revenue does certain large industrial sites and utility property appraisal. And the property is subject to taxation. Actually, a tax base for property tax is all property in Oregon. But there are properties subject to taxation, and there are properties that are not subject to or exempt from taxation. The examples of property subject to taxation are all privately owned real property, like land, buildings, fixed machinery and equipment, manufactured homes, and personal property used in business. Properties that are not subject to taxation, household furnishings, and has long histories and also certain intangible properties, and there are some discussions in the morning about this intangible property. Examples are stocks, bonds, and bank accounts. There are exempted properties, and some properties are assessed at a reduced rate. Examples of exempt properties are the property used for religious, fraternal, and government purposes. And some examples of reduced assessment occur in open space farmland, forest land, historical buildings, and properties owned by disabled or veterans. Tax expenditure occurs when certain properties are removed from assessment roll and thus excluded from property taxes. Examples include intangible personal property, as full exemption example, intangible personal property, federal, state, and local property, and personal property for personal use, and all this. And an example of partial exemption includes strategic investment program, historical property, properties owned by disabled veterans. And some properties are assessed, specially assessed, and examples include farmland, private forest land. Now, tax expenditure is a type of tax loss, property tax loss, but compression is another kind of loss being discussed a lot. Compression is the process used to reduce property taxes to the Measure 5 limits. And again, the limits are $5 for school purpose and $10 for general government for each 1,000 real market value. Again, for each property, school taxes and general government taxes are compared to their limits, respectively. Limits only apply to operating taxes, not exempt bonds. If exceeding Measure 5 limits when taxes are extended, then compression starts in a specific order, beginning with local option taxes. And when local option taxes are not there or exhausted to zero, then permanent rates will decline. And if you have any more questions about that process, we can ask John. Now,
actually, I do.
Please.
Because I'm interested in knowing or having you tell us what some of the causes of compression are, and also I'm interested in what comes next after the local option and how it's divided, because that's an area that we just don't talk about that much.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, John Phillips, Department of Revenue. I think I would probably say that the circumstances, as Paul mentioned earlier, in the education category, where you have school districts, ESDs, and community colleges with all tax rates, can create a situation where the rates times the market value creates the tax limit that would exceed, the taxes would exceed the limitation. As market values grow, the limit, the available taxes within the limit expands. As market value drops, the available limit compresses, because the taxes are calculated on the assessed value. The limit is a function of the market value. So that's why market value can have a real impact on whether or not there's compression.
So we're likely to see a lot more compression in the next couple of years as housing prices continue to deflate. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, yes. That's one of the factors. The other factor would be additional measures passed, and that I'm speaking of local options. So as local option taxes are passed and as value decreases in terms of market value, mm-hmm. you're going to see more and more incidences of compression on each as each property that's affected.
So have we had any cases where the local getting rid of the local option is not enough to solve the compression problem where they've had to go down the list?
Madam Chair, I don't know of any particular example, although I believe that does happen. You know, we'd have to do some research to find out exactly where that occurs and which and it occurs on a property-by-property basis, so you would have to look at each property to see,
oh, I see.
Where that's occurring.
So, Madam Chair, we just have that. That's one of the real complicating factors behind the local options. If, for example, a local district proposes a local option, you can't make a blanket statement and say this is how much it's going to affect individual taxes because it depends on how close they are to compression. Those that are assessed very close to market value because of conditions in their neighborhood, they're more likely to be under compression than those that are way below market value. So, again, it's a property-by-property basis. So it really is a source of confusion, I think, for voters on those kinds of options.
Even revenue chairs.
Well, it's very difficult, practically impossible, to precisely estimate the revenue impact. You have to get that spread among those individual properties.
Is there anything you could put together that would help us kind of get a broader picture of how this is working statewide and what it's likely to happen is if property values continue to go down?
I'd be happy to work with mm-hmm. Paul and Day on that.
We do, Madam Chair, have a county-by-county total of what the estimate of compression is, and you can see it does tend to be in those counties that haven't had a lot of market value growth, primarily on the east side. But we could look at that and see if we can get a little more detail on that.
Great. And Senator Telfer,
thank you. And how would giving you some background? 5 and 50 build in a structural deficit for local cities, for instance, and so cities are more and more looking at local options. So how's that going to impact the state budget along those lines as far as the data that you're accumulating? Because I'm seeing that more and more and more, having just come off of Central Oregon Cities Organization and being a city councilor for 6 years, I know that's what's happening because it's a built-in structural deficit with 5 and 50. And so local cities and municipalities are looking at other ways to raise money, and they are definitely talking local taxes.
Paul. If I would just, Senator Telfer, and that's a very good lead into your discussion tomorrow, which would be the Revenue Restructuring Task Force, which that was one of their conclusions exactly. And the chair of the task force, Lane Shetterly, will be here tomorrow to talk with the committee and Tim Nesbitt from the governor's office. So that's an issue. They've got some suggestions on how to diversify revenue. And there were some, we did look at various ways to modify Measure 50. But, and I think John has a nice slide on this, where measure, you know, you basically, in order to make any significant change to the property tax, you have to have a constitutional amendment, mm-hmm. very limited. So, really, where the place to go is to look for diversification at the local level.
And, Madam Chair, in answer to your second question, when local option taxes are compressed to zero, and they are all considered to be compressed equally, local options, not just the last one passed. They're all considered equally in the compression calculation. Once that's completed and still there's need for additional compression, then all the remaining levies, which are the permanent rate levies, are then compressed equally again.
Okay. So if you have three local options and you need a 10% reduction in local option to get to your compression level, or you need that much compression to get to your acceptable level, then you would take 10% off of all the local options rather than take it all from the most recent one. Is that what you're saying?
I think that's mathematically correct.
Yeah. Okay. Senator Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I actually had a question about the previous slide, so I don't know if you want to wait. It looks like we only have two more.
Any more compression questions before she... Okay, go ahead.
And before we move on to urban renewal, the advanced course, I guess.
Yes.
So on the tax expenditure slide, you have listed out some of the full exemptions, but are those just the top ones in value? Because there were some listed before, like fraternal organization, which I guess, is that still the term in the laws, fraternal organizations, property?
And Madam Chair and Senator Rosenbaum, yes, these are the examples that are on top of the list in terms of potential losses or not collection of non-collection of property taxes. One example is enterprise zone in a full exemption. It's $11-12 million in magnitude. An important program because these exemptions, full, partial, and special assessment, they're either consequences of laws or policy recommendations, policy programs. So they do their policy purposes and serve laws. These are just big items in each category. Yes.
And follow up, Madam Chair. So the fraternal exemption, that would be not just clubs that men belong to, but a category of clubs like, I don't know, the Elks come to mind, but I'm sure there are others. The term itself implies.
We don't have cigar bars in there, do we?
I will surely look up the definition of it, and then we'll get back to
you. Yeah, I mean, I could do that, too, but yeah. I'm just...
Is it based on the IRS code section?
I don't...
Paternal?
Madam Chair, a miracle just occurred, and I opened my tax expenditure manual to that page.
Oh, it's meant to be.
So the...
sounds biblical.
The description of... let's see... religious paternal obligation. Who benefits? Approximately 1,200 properties. Qualifying organizations include State Grange, American Legion, Veteran of Foreign Wars, Elks, Eagles, Masons, Moose, Odd Fellows, Knights of Pythias, and Knights of Columbus. Those are the ones listed here in our.
What about Knights of the Round Table?
All right,
I think there's a supplement.
Move along here. This conversation is deteriorating fast.
I'd like to give some time for John, but let me spend up a couple of minutes on Urban Renewal Agency. We don't have much time left, so I mean, not that this topic is not important. ORS Chapter 5, 457 gives each city and county the ability to activate an Urban Renewal Agency. And it has the power to propose and act on plans to eliminate, remedy, prevent, conserve, and rehabilitate blighted areas. Substantial funding, actually about $160 million out of $191 altogether, total urban revenue, urban renewal revenue comes from so-called division of tax revenue. That's portions taken out of local government property tax levies. Many urban renewal plans adopted before December 6, 1996 also may raise revenue through a special levy, and the revenue coming from there is called special urban renewal special levy revenue. By the way, division of tax is calculated by splitting local government property taxes between local government and the urban renewal agency. The split is recalculated every year based on value growth. That's what we talked about as excess value of $9.3 billion for 07-08 fiscal year. That's so the split is recalculated every year based on value growth within the plan area. both division of tax and urban renewal special levy are subject to Measure 5 limits. And if you have any other questions, I'll turn over the mic to John Phillips.
Okay, so the special levy on urban renewal, that would where would that fall in the compression scenario? If
In terms of priority?
Yeah, in terms of priority. Do you know that?
Madam Chair, yes, that would fall after all local options are exhausted. It would fall equally with the remaining levies.
Equally with the remaining levies. Okay, thank you. Mm-hmm. Okay, any questions before we... Are you done with your part of it,
yes,
Jay?
Ma'am.
Okay, any questions before we move on? Go ahead, John.
Okay, thank you. Again, John Phillips with the Department of Revenue. I was asked to talk a little bit about the administration part of the property tax system, and it is a joint venture between the Department of Revenue and the 36 counties, particularly the assessors and the tax collectors. Just want to talk a little bit about how that system works and what the results and outcomes are, and to identify any of the concerns there. Some of what Dave presented is covered in mine, so I will skip through a few things and over quickly. It was first established in 1844, the property tax, and it is the second largest. He talked about which districts and types of services are provided, including state public policy objectives, which we'll go into more later. And we have the department has the oversight responsibility. We'll talk about the how in terms of how it's done, how it's organized and structured, and how we get the job done. And also the what is sort of what are the outcomes and how does that affect who in terms of taxes and tax expenditures. There are also a couple of administrative issues in terms of how you might interact with the property tax. You may see a bill or two this session.
Oh.
In terms of how the property tax system is done, I'd like to talk just briefly about, use a metaphor in terms of the system's functioning as a sort of a interrelated structure that there's nourishing roots, the trunk, the branches, and the leaves that actually produce things like safe health and educated Oregonians with sort of the services we provide at the bottom and the in terms of education, assistance, and enforcement. The kinds of things that we do, like certain types of appraisals, certain mapping functions and appeals, and then the things that the counties, the tasks the counties perform in collection, valuation, and mapping. I do have a copy of the summary of the 1921 Marion County tax roll with me. They were generous enough to share that with me. You might want to take a quick look at it, but there was a total of $42 million on the roll for 1921 in Marion County. That includes the value of sheep and other things that might be curiosity for you.
That was their intangibles.
It might be that was an intangible value. The routes that we help provide from the department are continuing education because appraisers are required to be certified and continue their educational experience through professional qualifications. We provide supportive roles, like we actually handle the tax deferral for seniors and disabled, and so we perform that function, filing those, accepting those applications, processing, working with the counties. Other things we're involved with include the mass appraisal program, because it's not a situation where appraisers go out and appraise each property physically every year, but it's where they take sampling and then they create ratios and then they do trending. So it's the only way that we can get all million plus properties appraised each year on January 1. There are other subject area experts that we have in areas of exemptions, someone to sort of figure out what all the details are with the 123 exemption programs, budget law for local governments, timber, forest land valuation, and various others. We also manage the County Assessment Function Funding Account. That's why we have the acronym, because it's really... not many people will say that, but you create it in 1989, and it provides funding. About 23% of the funding for the assessment and taxation function in the county is funded through this grant fund. Counties apply for it annually, And as long as their programs meet minimum standards, then they are participating in that grant. And that's the $39 million, the most recent 07-08 contribution to that. And that dollar amount for the CAFA fund is decreasing. You can imagine document recording fees are going down. Again, back to the tree. We're now into the trunk area where the Department of Revenue provides mapping assistance. We provide help with appeals and certain types of appraisals. In the mapping area, all property, of course, is geographically referenced. And I know this past November, City of Salem voted on in excess of 20 annexations that all passed, and all of the maps have to be changed to reflect who now is in the city based on that vote. So annexations are the main, one of the most significant changes to the property that have to be maintained annually, and ownership changes also, and property does tend to change ownership, so we have daily occurrences. Taxing district boundaries change for reasons I mentioned. The Department of Revenue assists with that process as a central clearinghouse for those boundary changes, and we also perform all of the actual map changes digitally for 14 counties. 14 counties contract with us, and we perform that function. In addition to that, we are managing the what's called the ORMAP system. It's a system where all the maps are being transitioned into a digital format for all 36 counties, and you provided for a dollar for each document that's recorded on certain types of documents, and that dollar goes into what's called the ORMAP fund, and that provides grants to counties to update their system into a digital formats. There's an example of a aerial photo with the digital lot lines put in there, and this actually is a subdivision in which one of the previous house chairs lives. Just was a coincidence that it came up that way, somewhere in Polk County, I think. Let's see, where did I go? All the way to the end. Let me go back. I'm sorry. Close your eyes a second. Okay. The appraisal. The department appraises certain types of properties, and this became a negotiated thing back many years ago when there was so much work for the counties to do, and they said, well, it would be make more sense for the department to centrally assess some types of things. Actually, the central assessment of utility-type property, that's like electric companies, transportation companies, communication companies, that started in 1909. So our statutes go back to 1909 on that. But the larger industrial properties is a bit more recent, and some of that came about in 89 when you created the CAFA fund and you said we have to do some partnering here. So the department appraises large industrial properties, and the counties appraise residential, commercial, and small industrial property. The department also is involved in the appeals process, and the counties to some extent also. What we call the BOPTA is the local appeals. That's if you have a residential property, for example, and you want to appeal your values, you would go to a local board first. And then you could appeal it on to the tax court. In 07-08, 4,260. Just by way of information, I talked with the Deschutes County Assessor, and this year he already has 1,000 appeals. And you probably read in the paper, as values go down, people think their taxes will go down. But as you can imagine, in Deschutes County, one of the fastest growing market values in the state, the difference between the taxable value and the market value is extreme.
So do you think that's, anecdotally, do you think that's the reason why the increase in appeals is because people don't understand?
Madam Chair, I believe that's correct.
I get a head nod from the real expert here.
Mm-hmm. And also, a lot of people don't realize that the tax statement they get in November is for the January 1 date prior to that. So values could have been coming down the last 9, 10, 11 months, and that would not be reflected on the tax statement. That will be reflected on the next tax statement. So the tax court has two divisions, a magistrate division and a regular division, and the appeals very small overall when you think of the million plus accounts there are out there. Back to the tree. We're into the branches now, and this is where the county is involved more directly or almost exclusively in calculating your taxes, all of the values. They also collect all the taxes and distribute all the taxes, and they maintain all the records and do most of the customer contact. The leaves, of course, you know about the services that local governments provide. There's also the public policy objectives for the tax expenditures they referred to, and there's a lot of different tax expenditure purposes. I've just listed three. We'll get into more of that later. The general pie of all the potential, Day talked about $4 billion, but the pie itself is larger than that when you think about all the tax expenditures added to the tax revenue. So we have the system is able, let's say in 2007-08, to generate $7.5 billion. Roughly $4 billion of that goes to local governments from their levies, and the rest goes to is just not collected. I'm going to skip over these because these were things that they covered very well in terms of the slices of the pie, and they're on your handout. Some of the local government services, and they covered those. This is a more exhaustive list of the types of public policy expenditures that exist in the 123 property tax exemption programs or special assessments. And fraternal, yep, well, we have fraternities and sororities there, but you know that exists. And that's the, let me go back, that is the tree, and that is sort of the whole system in a nutshell. The second part of the presentation is the what. Okay, so what do we do now that we're organized and structured, and that all of it revolves around values, tax rates, billings, collections, and exemption expenditures. Just to give you a relative sort of a feel for the size of the task, about 2 million accounts, total market value, roughly $500 billion. Taxable value, number of taxing districts, 1,192. Number of code areas, these are those areas where if it was just a county and no other taxing districts, there would only be one code area. But every time you add a new district with a new line and a boundary that overlaps, a new code area is created. Taxes imposed, that's that $4 billion number. And taxes collected with 1 year, it should read 97% to 98%. So, I apologize. Your handout might reflect that. I'm not sure which handout you got.
It says 99%.
Okay, so that would be 97% or 98%.
Senator Morse.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We were advised Friday by the state economist that the December quarterly estimates for personal income tax was the largest drop in the history of the state. Are we seeing any changes in the collection on property taxes?
Madam Chair, Senator Morris, I was at the assessor's conference last week in Eugene, and I spoke with about 8 different county treasurers, tax collectors, and they all almost unanimously reported that the collections are about on par with normal tax years. There's been, slight less, maybe percentage or less point difference for a couple of counties, but most of them are right on par at about 85-86% so far in the tax cycle. That's with the second trimester payment is due February 15th, and the final one is due in May. So They did report that some people are tending to pay in trimesters, where before they had paid in full. They're seeing a little more trimester payment, but the answer is stable.
I've been waiting about 2 months for one shred of good news, and I think you just gave it. Well, Senator Telfer.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I'm going to burst that bubble a little bit. I know we put together the City of Bend's budget for the next 2 years and reduced it to 94.5%, and that was based on the finance officer's calls to other cities in the state. So the cities are saying it's going to go down. And so I would imagine the counties were going to go down too. So So that is about a 3% decrease.
And Madam Chair and Senators, that the number I gave you was the percentage sort of collected, so the status of collection so far for the last roll turn. Now, projections for future could be down.
Right.
And I think collectors are generally thinking that collections will be down because of people's inability to make the payment, or but no one's got numbers on that yet.
And then with when a house is foreclosed, what does the tax liability tend to get ignored, or is the bank responsible for that? How does that work when a property is foreclosed?
Madam Chair, what I'm hearing on that is that the mortgage companies are paying the taxes, so the foreclosed properties, that's what I'm hearing. I don't have any data on that at all.
Okay. Thank you. We need to excuse our esteemed staff director here.
Mm-hmm. I will be back.
You'll be back.
I'll be back.
Okay. All right, go ahead.
Okay. Property tax fundamentals are existing values are set in the Constitution. Tax rates are set in the Constitution. New values are set in the Constitution through that changed property ratio. Payments and collections are generally a statutory phenomena. So there, I guess this slide is the one Paul was referring to, that a lot of, not everything, but a lot of what happens in the property tax is in the Constitution. And you know from last November's Measure 57 that it's not impossible to make a change in when the double majority amendment to the Constitution was passed last November, changing that situation.
Actually, I believe that was Measure 59.
59. Thank you for the correction. Values, there is real market value with an underline under the capital V, because that, in my mind, is the only value. Maximum assessed value is just a number that was picked out of time and ratioed 3% a year. So it really doesn't reflect a value. It's just a number we're tracking. Assessed value is the lesser of those top two. So it's not a value necessarily either, unless it's real market. Specially assessed value is a value that's less than the market value on properties that, for what policy reason you've chosen, as such as maintaining farms or maintaining forest land or maintaining vertical housing areas or these kinds of things. And there's each specially assessed value has its own maximum assessed value related to that specially assessed value. And then there are many, many, many other kinds of values that you don't probably want to know about, just because it gets too complex and it's not that useful. But we have to deal with them. Tax rates, we've already talked about those tax rates. The math is tax rate times value equals tax unless one of the variations occurs. Just a comment about changed property ratios. I think we've already talked about this, so I think we've covered that in the questions and in Dave's presentation. Here's that first year collections, about 97-98%, and that's simply because property taxes are against the property, and over the 6 year period that's allowed in the foreclosure process, virtually all of the taxes are collected within the statutory scheme for collecting those taxes. Very, very little goes beyond the sixth year. Collector's work is dominated by personal property because it's not, it's movable, and so it changes hands more frequently. And so 90% of the work, maybe you might say, is spent on 10% of the things, and one of those things is personal property. Another is refunding, and another, the final one I listed is roll corrections, because there are so many changes due to appeals or exemption applications that are filed late after the roll is finalized, corrections are made. They spend a lot of time in the county working on these things. The types of exemptions vary. Now, this is a little deeper than what Dave talked about, so I'll spend just a moment on this. You think about how we're going to expend taxes rather than collect them. One way is through a partial exemption, like the disabled veterans partial exemption. There's full exemptions, such as for churches. There's special assessments. It's an assessed value, but it's lower than what everybody else is paying to incent certain behavior. Taxable value freezes. You're familiar with historic type properties. Deferred taxes for seniors and disabled folks. delayed foreclosure to prevent people from being kicked out of their home. There are certain programs. There are temporary type expenditures like 3 or 5 years for the enterprise zone, 12 years for hybrid poplars, 15 years for certain historic property, and it goes on and on and on. So there's a lot of variation in how you go about creating tax expenditures.
So with the special assessment, would that include the farm and forest?
Madam Chair, yes.
Okay.
There's different ways you can test all of these. Some of these you can say, well, we'll give you a 100% exemption, but it's means tested, or it's age tested, like the senior deferral program, 62. Or whether you're a corporate, your corporate status, maybe it's for only for nonprofits. There's specific use tests. You may, in some cases, you have to maintain certain employment levels or certain investment levels or certain hiring and wage thresholds. So it just gives you kind of a sense of all of the variations and permutations you have. You may see a tax exemption expenditure bill this session. So
you will indeed.
And what's really important to remember for tax administrators is that to the extent that you can make that expenditure similar to what's already being done, then you avoid certain kinds of activities that might require hand processing, because counties, that's going to be a labor-intensive thing if it's a new way to do something. Creating small benefits for in complex processes can be difficult, or new types of benefit calculations, or when you change programs frequently, all of which is within your purview, but it's a tax administration issue. This slide is talking about pre-1997, and the next one will be on post-1997, and it talks about what the issues that Paul mentioned came out in your meeting up in Tigard, or Tualatin, and wherever that meeting
Tigard.
Was. Tigard, yes. Mm-hmm. In terms of the uniformity pre-measure, 50 was based on real market value, and the uniformity is a different then than it is today. Predictability, these two you could arguably say switched during the 97 and pre-97 and post-97, because for the taxpayer the predictability was low because the market could change up or down in any given year significant percentages, and they didn't ever necessarily know what they might pay, whereas post-97 the predictability is higher for the taxpayer but lower for the local governments. So just some things to think about in terms of... Finally, I just wanted to mention that the property tax was a major topic in the governor's task force, which you'll hear about soon. 5 out of 10 of the findings revolved around the property tax in the area of uniformity, sufficiency, and tax administration. And that is all I had.
Thank you very much, and we'll be hearing some more about governor's task force at our meeting tomorrow when we talk about the tax restructuring, which dealt at some length with property tax issues. Are there questions from the committee? Thank you both for a comprehensive discussion. And now we will move to our guru of vice and depredation.
And I think the Marion County Assessor will want his tax rollback, if I can get that before we leave.
Oh, by the way, I wanted to thank you for bringing that.
Okay.
Paul has it in his custody.
Okay.
And I was curious as to why the date was changed on the cover from 1922 to 21. The charts said that was just a typographical error.
Madam Chair, I don't know. I'll have to ask Richard Kreiser when I see him next.
Yeah, it was a very fun thing to have. Thank you.
And Madam Chair, Senator Morrison and I were noticing that dogs were also taxed in addition to sheep and other animals as personal property apparently at that time, and raised a considerable amount of revenue. So
I think we may have learned something here that...
We could allow dogs in the capital
and
tax
then
them.
Charge.
How about we don't allow dogs in the capital and tax them? Okay, welcome, Mazin.
Afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. This microphone. And for the record, Mazin Malik with Legislative Revenue Office. And I think you've introduced my function already. If you have to say it again, if you smoke, gamble, drink, I am your guy. I'll take you, transport you with a car as well. That's also in my portfolio. If you need 911 help, I'll text that for you as well. And again, if you get too much into debt, I'll do your bonding as well. So those are the things that I do for Legislative Revenue Office and for you as your staff. Lottery is the fun part of my portfolio. It's the gambling section, if you will. Oregon Lottery, of course, we all would like to think about it in different ways. I also have to mention that in the audience, Director Dale Penn with the Oregon Lottery is here. And he volunteered in case you have any questions. He'll be able to answer if I'm not able to satisfy your question.
Welcome, Director Penn. We're glad to have you.
And I think he will host you on Monday as we are going to the lottery.
We're going on a gambling trip committee on Monday. Don't bring any money because we really shouldn't gamble, but we will tour the lottery.
Well, that's true. Although, you know, what we would like all to think about the lottery is actually winning and opening the champagne, having fun. Now, I have usually built in my presentations a number of aids and visual and audio. Unfortunately, the audio didn't make it with this computer, so I'll be commenting on which you should have expected to hear when you don't hear it. However, I've also added few visual things that I will bring it to your attention every once in a while. You see the balls up here. These are the ones that without numbers. So the lottery, when you check that machine, I don't think they do it anymore. It's the computer, but you remember that sucking machine with the balls number 6, 7, but these are 5 here. However, this is a lottery thing. Okay, terminology of the lottery, what we do with it. This is what we will talk about, also a little history, what net proceeds are, traditional lottery, video lottery, transfers and other issues. Now, first thing about some terminology when we're talking about the lottery, revenue is the first thing, of course. That's what we have the lottery for. There is game revenues, and there's other revenues, such as interest and claimed prizes and so on. And those prizes. And then you have net receipts. And in lottery, that's game revenue less prizes. We haven't paid for anything yet. Then comes the expense of the game and the operation. Then you have something called contingency reserves that is for just in case kind of things for the lottery agent, for the agency. Then you would take those net proceeds that we've introduced up here and take... the net proceeds will be the net receipts less the expenses. This is a whole different definition of what net is. So a quick history that you have also in your packet, just to go through in the progression of how lottery developed in the state. Of course, lottery is an old concept. It's always been described as the voluntary tax. We tax ourselves voluntarily for good causes. It started in Oregon in 1984. That's, I think, November 4th. It was voted in by initiative petition to have traditional games and have all these proceeds going to economic development. With time, in 1989, there was legislative action to create sport action. The sport action lottery, and also to authorize video. This was suspended by the governor then, but the 91 legislative session put it back again and voted the lottery again. And also put prohibition for private lotteries. in the same session, there was a dedication of 2.5% of net receipts to counties, counties' economic development, that is. In 95, Measure 21 added into the Constitution the clause of financing public education as well as economic development as an allowable use of lottery funds. And the second thing it did, it gave lottery bonds the first claim on revenue. So it became a lot more secure in payments. I have to add that Oregon is one of the few states that have those lottery bonds, well-defined program that comes as a revenue piece in the state. Also dedicated 15% of the net proceeds to the Education Endowment Fund. This is the father of the predecessor, if you will, of the Education Stability Fund. The 1998 Initiative Petition 66 dedicated 15% to parks, watersheds, protection, and so on. And so it dedicated that amount, and in the same time, it made it an allowable use of the lottery funds. The 99 legislative action dedicated not less than 1% of video net proceeds to problem gambling. And the 2002 third special session, I think some of you still remember the third special session, although we would like to forget third, fourth, and fifth. The third special session converted the Education Endowment Fund, the one we spoke of, to the Education Stability Fund, or Education Stabilization Fund. And that changed the dedication on it from 15% to 18%, but made it conditional to being 5% of the general fund. Once it reaches this threshold of 5% of the general fund, it becomes 15%, and that 15% goes to a new fund called the School Capital Matching Subaccount. This fund exists today, but it's empty. It doesn't have any money in it. Of course, there was expectation that we will get to this point probably the next or the coming biennium, the 2009-2011 biennium. Now, of course, that requires that you keep filling the ESF, the Education Stability Fund, until it gets to be 5% of the general fund. It is probably likely that this will not continue happening. 2005 legislative session have taken the step of repealing sports action games. And sports action games was an impediment to some college events. So it was repealed all the gambling on the sports action and other sports games. And instead of the revenue was going to the sports, college sports, it dedicated 1% of the proceeds to the athletic programs in colleges. Now, this is where the audio is missing. It just shows you where it is. The traditional lottery games.
What was the audio on that? Could you hum a few bars?
you remember the song that was the lucky dog? Quack, 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 quack.
Okay, never mind.
All right.
Forget I ever brought it up.
Okay. This is 2007-2008 net receipts. It just shows you a percentage of how these things are. We always think of the big games that we hear about, megabucks, but actually in revenue terms, it's only 10% of the pie. And the Powerball, which is also very famous, is only about 24% of that pie. The thing that makes most money for the traditional games is the old games that before introduction of video poker and video lottery. Instance is the largest with 34%. Now that all actually is a good amount, but relative to what we look in the total lottery amount is $118 million is primarily a small one. Okay, that all audio is gone, unfortunately. Now, just to take another look of how traditional game revenue looks in percentages, or actually in an amount of dollars, you want to see how this net revenue, it varied with time. It went up with the same way that, you know, the envelope of prizes have changed. Expenses about stayed the same. All these, if you look at them in percentage terms, you would see that expenses stayed about the 16% that is mandated by the constitutional dedication, about 16% of the revenues. However, the revenue, you see that it's goes less as you have more money allocated to prizes. Now, the
was that a policy decision, or how did that happen where you had a higher percentage dedicated to prizes?
Well, these are primarily events, I think, that have to do with how the sales and market shares and so on occur between games. And I think these, through the commission and the lottery, are able to offer more in order to be able to maintain the amounts of revenue that they bring in. So it was... Mr. Director, am I on? That's a confirmation from... So it is in that sense a way. For example, Powerball at one point, they all nationally as a whole game have changed the matrix of how much you have number of you pull in, and when the numbers come in and increases the matrix that is increases the probability of winning, basically. And that had the effect of bringing more players into the game.
Yeah, maybe we could ask Dale Penn to come up here, because, you know, where I look at this chart, you've gone from 25% in 84 and 85, and even higher than that in 87 and 89, and now we're down to below 20% in terms of our net revenue, and the expenses have stayed the same. So could you just tell us a little bit more? Is it because of the change in the mix of games to line games and that type of thing?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I'm Dale Penn, Director of the Lottery. What I have seen in the 4 years that I've been at the lottery, this is actually a hot topic for all lotteries. And what has occurred is... you have some lotteries that are only 5 years old or less, and ticket sales increase in those lotteries, but then they stabilize. And if you look at it, there is another, slide, the next couple of, or maybe that slide right there, you'll see where in Oregon, first several years, sales, first 4 years, increased dramatically. Then they kind of tapered off. And you see that occur, and then they jumped up again. But they jumped up because new games were added. And so
that
you
when
saw,
video poker came on?
No, this doesn't deal with video at all. He'll talk about video in a minute.
Right.
But you add then Keno. You add other types of games, the multi-state game, Megabucks, and so that's really what saw that increase. And right now other states are dealing with how do we increase these dollars because they have the same kind of budgetary pressures as Oregon, and so they look at adding games. But the ticket itself is has been flat for a number of years, and you can see that our traditional types games have been flat for a number of years. And what we believe is happening is that we need new types of games. Now you don't have so much. I have two sons that are in their mid-20s. If it isn't on the internet, they don't know it. And they don't play it. And so you see lotteries trying to branch out in other types of gaming. There are some federal restrictions on that capability, but tickets themselves and some of our traditional games are kind of going the way of our players are getting older, and that's dissipating. So that's a challenge, and that's one thing about the Powerball game. It was just changed this month, and that was one reason it was changed. Florida was added as a state, but trying to make it new, bring in new players. But that is a very difficult problem with the traditional game. Other states have looked at this and said the way we have to increase revenue is pay more prizes. And so I think that Oregon probably did that in the past. We have not done that recently. We've tried to be real careful about that because, as you can see, that bottom one, net revenue, is the most important. If we're going to pay a bunch more prizes, increase our sales, but make less money for to transfer to the state, that's a concern. But this is a challenge that many states are dealing with right now in the traditional product, and they actually are trying to increase prizes to hope to increase the sales so that even their percentage is less, the pie is bigger and they make more money. So that's the challenge.
Okay. Thank you.
And you see, Madam Chair, the amounts were at a certain level in the 93, 94, and they started coming down. And then with the change, they stabilized and went back up. Mm-hmm. So these are the changes that come with changing of the matrix. Now we go to the green color, indicating money.
And that's, thank you for clarifying that.
Just those subtle things. The video lottery, this gentleman is playing and having fun. Video lottery revenue is by magnitude, is so big to the point where you start looking at a whole different conception of what is net revenue, looking at this small green little tiny bit over here, with all those amounts being in prizes, and the tiny red segment being the expenses.
Now, do you include in prizes the commissions that you pay to the retailers? That's in expenses?
That's in expenses. That will be still in expenses. Prizes, just these are the amounts of the dollars coming into the machine. Also includes the dollars that are generated as prizes in the machine and they continue to be played.
So. Madam Chair, if I could state, the reason you have a $12 billion figure is we have to track every play on every machine. And so someone pushes the button and they play and they get some credits. So if they cashed out right then, that's money they win. Most people keep playing, but you have to track all of those credits. And so when you see this bar here, you'll see another slide later. As we went to line games, we tried to program our games at about 92% payout. And so that's where they're at. And that gold bar kind of shows that 92%. And so when we discuss the revenue, the almost $1 billion of revenue for the biennium, that really is that small 8% that's left over. Everything comes out of that 8%, 92% goes back as prizes.
So how do you determine that the level of, that seems like a very high winning ratio. And I gave up gambling years and years ago after putting $20 in a machine and losing it in like 15 seconds. Mm-hmm. So that's inconceivable to me. And 92%, I mean, do other states have a lower percentage? Or?
Well, Madam Chair, particularly when we went to line games, and there is a slide later on, I'll show you average payment of prizes. When we had video poker by itself, there was one game that paid out at almost 94%. And guess which game players wanted to play almost exclusively? players can tell the differences in that programming. When we went to, and we still have that poker game, by the way. It's the most popular poker game remains. But when we went to line games, we had to decide what are we going to target as the prize payout for these games. And we tried to look around the industry, and we saw that 92% seemed to be an industry standard. Now, casino's going to have a wide-ranging type. You can see different payouts on different machines on a floor. You can see advertising that we pay 99% and all this stuff. And there might be one machine that pays 99%. But 92% seemed to be an industry average. It's been very popular. It's worked very well. And so we've stayed with that.
Okay, go ahead, Nelson.
And when you look at this picture in percentage-wise, that point becomes more pronounced. This is where you have percentage of prizes, and you see that also at a certain time those were increased a bit. This is in the 97-98 times, and that was, this is when of course, this is including. Think of this is the time when we are looking at the gaming from the tribal gaming casinos and so on. And that is, if you put these two, both traditional and video, together, in order to look at a bigger picture of what the lottery revenue comes. You would still see that the small number of revenue, all the revenue that we talk about and comes into the state is just that teeny tiny piece in the bottom versus the other percentages. However, that piece makes a significant amount. If you look at it again as percentages, you'd see how the change with time, this is the envelope of change, if you will.
Yeah, I presume that reduction in the percentage of expenses was when you reduced the commissions for
this retailers? Reduction, Madam Chair, this came interestingly with the introduction of video lottery. The traditional lottery had about 16% expenses. Once you introduced the video lottery, it had started bringing in a very large amount of revenue, with the percentage of expenses being a lot smaller. So in a way, it had the effect of shrinking the expenses in total percentage.
Because of economies of scale, but right. I'm not seeing an explanation. Because I think this doesn't fold in the line games yet, does it?
It does, and it does it right here, and this time frame.
Because when you went to line games, isn't that when you went to the lower
commissions? And we will go through this, okay. Madam Chair. But this is true, and you could see where net revenue had a slight uptick from both line games, and in the same time, because you had this effect of both introducing the line games and then changing the commissions. Probably the change in the commissions will not be noticeable as much because you have introduced all that amount of new revenue coming from the line games, which smothered all the effects that you would have otherwise noticed from the change in commissions. Now, the transfers, as mandated by law and by the different constitutional requirements, this is how, in a way, it looks. And you could see with time how new colors to the bars are introduced as new laws, new constitutional amendments, and so on come in. And you could also see how the bonding segment of lottery revenue used to be really small in the beginning, down here, and how much it is at this time when we're looking at the 2009-11. This is with the new, this is status quo, so 0709 is where you look at.
Senator Morris.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dale, why do we carry such large reserve balances?
I beg your pardon, I didn't hear that.
Why do we carry such large reserves balance?
Madam Chair and Senator Morris, this isn't anything that the lottery is retaining. This is showing these are dollars that are actually transferred to the state. And the balance is figures that then are, Maz and I have to explain that a little bit more, but those are sent out to state programs, one of those four.
Senator Morris, Madam Chair, Senator Morris, the balance in this picture, if we mean it to be the remaining amount of revenue that is not dedicated. So these are the amounts, balance opened for legislative appropriation, if you will.
Well, wait a second, because we've got the dedicated funds for the stability fund and for
parks and recreation.
For parks and recreation.
County.
But I thought then the only other uses for it were for education and economic development.
Madam Chair, that's correct. Every time we change, or there has a constitutional amendment, that use has been added to the Constitution. So you could do it as an economic development, education, or parks and recreation and enhancement of watersheds and so on. So this piece, the other, this includes the 1% for problem gambling, mm-hmm. includes the 1% for college athletics, which is also an amount that allowable because of the educational aspect of it.
Okay. But then where does the economic... So the economic development and the education are both included in that balance?
The balance would be all the amounts that are open for appropriations. So after you have the Education Stability Fund and the Parks and Recreation, you have all of these amounts that are open for appropriations, and they do go to these different uses as through the Ways and Means process.
Okay. Senator Hess.
Thank you. Now, we're going to lose the Parks and Recreation, right, in the next biennium.
Right.
So that red will disappear, and the purple part, the balance, will increase by 15% or $200 million.
That is correct, Madam Chair, Senator Hess. This is if there is no renewal of that clause within the Constitution, that will happen. However, you'll still have an allowable use of lottery for parks and recreation and watershed, but the dedication of the 15% would probably go
and
away.
We'll be able to use that because it's under the heading, you can define that as economic development?
Because of the constitutional language still allows for it.
But so it doesn't dedicate.
But it doesn't dedicate the
I didn't realize that.
Yeah.
So, Senator Morris.
Thank you. Doesn't it sunset in 13?
Yes.
So we have...
Yeah.
One more biennium.
Right, biennium. Okay.
Now, just to put them in numbers, the distributions first, obviously there is an understanding that a lot of bonds take the first cut out of the revenues. 2.5% goes to video net receipts to county economic development, 18% education stability funds, with the sideboards of the 5% of the general fund, and then 15 in case we reach that threshold, 15% to parks and recreation. And that is also restricted to be half to parks and half to fish and wildlife. That's also one college athletics and one to minimum government. And then county fairs get 1%. The rest is legislative allocation, as we see. Now, because of that, if you look at the pie, as we look at it in the 2009-2011 forecast of amounts, and here you would have seen, or you would have heard, a cash machine going, but it's not here anymore. But it's $1.4 billion. Or $1,409 million, and that's how it distributes from the 2009-2011 in the December forecast. One thing that you need to pay attention to, that this forecast or that forecast in December assumes that we have reached the 5% of the general fund, and therefore the 18% going to the Education Stability Fund resorts to 15% going to the capital sub-account. Now, that is not necessarily what's might transpire.
How come it's 4.2% for the county fairs?
Well, counties and the fairgrounds, yeah. Remember, they get 2.5% of right away from the amounts that go to the video. Then you pay for bonds, and then everything else gets the you add the 1%. So the percentages that you look at here is not exactly what the percentages that you've just seen in the previous page, because of that, how it tumbles down with the process. Now, a few issues that we'll be looking at or will be looked at. The line games, the payout percentages, these are always issues that come out every time we look into the lottery compensation, expenses, and now we add the smoking ban. And finally, something that we call the perfect storm. This is the snow and the freeze that we went through with the economic meltdown, and snow and freeze with a meltdown. I mean, that's an interesting contrast, isn't it? And then that trivializes the ban, of course. And let's see how that works. So, the line games, lottery line games, they went through a period of explosive growth. And again, if you had the audio of this, you would hear this explosion a few times going. Net receipts in the 2003-2005, they were increased by 131 million, or 132.7. That's 13.5. And remember, the introduction of line games was toward the ends of that biennium. But the 2005-2007 biennium saw $460 million increase in net receipts. That's about 41.4% increase. That's at that time we kept asking ourselves month after month, when how long are we going to keep seeing 30% growth for which period of time? Now in 2007-2009, this is based on December's Office of Economic Analysis forecast. We're looking at only an increase of $242 million. That's 15.4%. Now that, remember, a lot of this is still not realized, so a lot of it is still a forecast number. And we will see in a few minutes that that might not occur. So if you look at it in a different way about the percentage growth, just to give it more annual look, you would see it goes from 7.2 and 6.7. I mean, these are what we were looking at as the growth patterns that we were used to with the video poker and so on. And you introduced the line games, and you have one year, a jump of 31.8%, second year of 23.1%. Now, this year, this 2008, this is actual number. It's only 8.9. I mean, it's funny how we say it's only 8.9, but it was still growing. But we started seeing the slowdown in the growth. And a final couple slides. I'll put more numbers of how it looks.
Chair, if I could interject one thing here. The earlier slides where we talked about these huge amounts of $12 billion, that's counting credits. And I think those are very misleading to even look at those slides, even though Mazen likes them. These are much more important because it is actual dollars that are cashed out, that are put into the machines, that come back to the state. I know that exactly 4 years ago, as I sat before this committee, we were ending up the 2003-05 biennium. And we were projecting about $750 million to be transferred that biennium. by the end of, here we are in January, by the end of June. And yet, as you can see, over the next two biennium, we changed up to $1.3 billion. This figure of 1.4, but for some of these things we're going to talk about as challenges right now in the economy, we aren't going to make 1.4. But you can see that explosive growth and the tremendous amount of money that came in, primarily to education, but for all of these purposes that were available. So I think it has been a dramatic change, and it's something that we're still adjusting with. But so when we look at prize payout, that is something that players pay particular attention to and has been very successful for us.
And the prizes are taxable, so that goes into the forecast as another actual source. In other words, this revenue stream doesn't include the positive tax benefits of the prizes themselves, correct?
Madam Chair, the prizes over a certain amount are taxable.
Above $600, we withhold on prizes above $600.
But most of the prizes that you would get are not necessarily of that caliber. You might get $50 or $20 or $50. So
do they still have liability for those, even though you don't withhold?
Legally, they should.
As Madam Chair, if they're truthful, yes.
But there is a lot.
Everything you earn.
So the 2009 now is becoming a question mark, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Now, this is what we were talking about, the prize percent. This is a way to look at it. When you isolate it from everything else, you would see how it started at a certain level here, and then it was drastically ratcheted up. This is the highest time we've ever paid at 93.86%. And now, as you could see, a slight decline in that percentage.
And Madam Chair, you can see that difference. That's the difference between almost 89% and 93 or 92. And so when we targeted, that was a very important decision. What do we program line games for? And we targeted that over close to 75% of our play is on line games. And so when it's 92%, that's why that line is coming back to 92. And that's the way it will kind of smooth out over years.
Do you still have something programmed at 93.86%?
That one poker game that I mentioned, Madam Chair,
okay,
that is still very important to poker players, yes.
But the line games are getting to be so big that they are averaging out the numbers.
That's the gateway game.
The gateway game.
So if you look at the annual growth in video and the different components, prizes, percentage, growth, gross amounts, and net revenue, this is how it looks. And you could see how there are this kind of graph here, and then goes down. That's for the gross. However, the net, you have, besides the times when it started way back here, the net amounts, you would see that we've gotten the highest percentage of net at the 2005-2006, although with the introduction of the line games, the numbers are coming up. Amount of revenue, actual physical absolute revenue is coming up, but as a percentage of the amounts that go in, it actually is decreasing in the
growth. Okay, Mazza, we're going to have to speed this up a little bit because we're getting a little short of time.
Oh, we are getting short of time. Okay, then I won't go about the old rates. Those are done with. These were the old rates everybody didn't like at 32%.
that was convenient, wasn't it?
They came up with a new one in 2004. These were for poker. This was a new setup of rates, about three and two. And those also were renegotiated with the introduction of Poker Online in 2005, and that brought the overall average to the 22-26. Yet, then in 2007, there was an introduction of even such a pen were able to get a lot of the retailers to go into a different arrangement, so 21-25%. Now, that have increased, obviously, the amount returned to the state that comes in. So this is a quick discussion that always dominates is why is a retail compensation is important. And the one way of looking at revenue, some people would think revenue from lottery will always come in at the same time. It's always constant going on. And the more you would have, the higher percentage you would have retailer compensation going that way, the less you would get in net revenue. I mean that's logical how it works. The other way of looking at revenue amounts, you would see that it is a curve type. So you have gross revenue growing as more you give incentive to retailers. So if you give them more and more incentive, they will have more and more incentive to grow your revenue and push it to more and more customers. However, there comes a time when you start growing with net revenue and then it starts coming down because sooner or later your compensation will eat up all your revenue. So which part of these two things would work? And when we put them together, we get the economist nirvana, two intersecting lines. This is when we think this is would probably be the when you maximize return, if you could find out where the points of meeting between these two lines are. And of course, just to emphasize a point, and here would be a drum roll of doing this. And just to underline the point of the expenses, you remember when we were talking about at the time when there was only traditional games, you had 16% or such about in expenses. traditional continued to be at about 16%. Now you introduced video, and you see that expenses took a quick drop down. And if you add them both together, you get this black line. So the total is how you... And at the end, we would have just stopped here. However, I know President yesterday was talking about dark clouds in the horizon and the freezing and the ice. So what's happening this year? There are a few things that we have to look at. The smoking ban, we were expecting at the time of the smoking ban that there will be an impact on lottery about 1% to 2% decrease in the growth rate. However, at that time when we were looking at it, that lottery was growing by 30% a year. So, and after all, the big question was, who's going to notice if you decline by 1% or 2% if you're increasing by 30? I mean, that was not necessarily a slam dunk kind of idea. Now, with the stabilization of the lottery growth, if you look at that 1% to 2%, what we're looking at this time, and that's what is nested in the forecast by DAS, Office of Economic Analysis, about 7.5 to 15 million per year. That's the 1% to 2% that you get to shave off the level of growth. But see, as dark as this is, we were still, you know, the revenue, there's still a ray of hope in the side here with the blue. Now, but if you start looking at the freeze and snow, now this is the economic meltdown. Now, we say this might trivialize the ban one more time. In the 2 weeks of the storms December 20th, was it, till the 28th, 29th, those 2 weeks only, if you compare what what actual revenue came in compared to the December forecast on these 2 weeks alone, it was $8.1 million below forecast just in 2 weeks. If you compare that to the September forecast, that's 27.4% below the expected revenue. That's $9.4 million. Now, that might be only a temporary thing because of the snow and the freeze and the icy currents. However, if you look at the economic conditions that we seem to not be able to shake away, if you look at the 29 months from the time of the beginning of the biennium until today, you're looking at about 18.7 million below December forecast. Remember, December forecast folds actuals into it. So it already have folded up to October in actuals. But it's still 2.6% below. If you look at September forecast, that's your 37.9 million below. That's 4.2%. If you try a more drastic... Now, remember, the biennial forecast is 2 years. So if you ignore that fact and you just compare the 29 months or 29 weeks of this year that we've gone through with the 29 weeks of 1998 fiscal, the comparison is about $212 million below. That is a decrease rather than negative growth, if you will.
And what you're saying is we should have put the smoking ban into effect a year earlier when no one would have noticed. Is that correct?
Well, I'm thinking now that nobody would notice either. I mean, 31.6% already. Who's going to notice 1 or 2%? But that's that is the case. So that's what you're looking at this point. The lottery is looking at these level of decreases. And that's at that time, I think the state economist was saying, if you're looking at the lottery to save the general fund, I don't think you have high hopes.
Madam Chair, if I could just put out to you that any of you who come out on Monday and tour, we'll have some time if you have some specific questions to go over this. Obviously, the economic downturn has had a tremendous impact on us, and we are in our second week of the smoking ban. And whereas in the past we were averaging around $17 million a week, the last 2 weeks we've been $13 million. And so it is having an impact. How much is economy? How much is smoking ban? It's a little of both. I think it's a lot more economy than it is anything. I was trying to look at average bet, and we've seen in 2007 when things were going very well, our average bet in video was about $1.07, and it is now 97 cents. And so we saw that really starting to change in the last few months, and we believe that is the economy. But we'd be happy to answer other questions as you come out.
So. Okay, thanks. We have committee members who are going to other committees, so we've taken this to the very end, and I appreciate it very much. Thank you. And we are adjourned.